I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is the author of Navigating Life, Things I Wish My Mother Had Told Me. Margot Bergen found herself with three children. Her daughter was 9 years old, and her family was experiencing a series of rough times, addiction, illness, depression, job loss, and death. And she started thinking, because she had three children, she was raising them pretty much by herself, that neither religion nor school would help her children address these kinds of questions about life and the bad things that happen in life and a moral compass to guide you through life and the kinds of things that it's good for children to know as they set off on their own. So she took pen to paper, and for 10 years she started writing to illuminate and to interpret life for her children, to guide them and to give them an account of their lives together and an account of her life apart from them as well. And so it's a book of advice, and it's a book of her experiences as well. And Margot's had some very interesting work experiences. She has worked all over the world and focused on international development, alleviating poverty, women's leadership. She's worked for the World Bank, for the Interfaith Action on Global Poverty, United Way, and is now at ORB Media. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Margot, and here's how you can reach our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that is @KDunnShow. Margot, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Thank you. What a great idea to do this for your children. It makes me wish I had done this. It's a little bit late now, but maybe not all that late. It's just it's a wonderful thing. And you were pretty open about yourself in addition to giving them very valuable advice. But it came from a dark place. Is it fair to say that you were going through a rough time as a family and you wanted your children to be able to navigate those times?
Yes, it did. And I think actually a lot of introspection sometimes comes from darkness, and hopefully it takes you back into the light. Yes, there were a lot of things that were happening all at once that were pretty dramatic and traumatic. And I thought one night or 3 o'clock in the morning, oh my goodness, why didn't my parents or my mother tell me about how to deal with all of these different events? So it came from a place of darkness trying to survive. But I think over the 10 years of writing, it then sort of morphed into something that was really about also, you know, the opportunities and how to thrive in life and how to create a very intentional framework for living.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of that, your mom would have had a hard time doing all of that for you because she was suffering as well, wasn't she?
She was. She had had, when I was 18 or 19, a fairly major breakdown, mm-hmm. which lasted on and off, and a great person, but somebody who was suffering. And in the, I think, late 80s, when that went on, particularly in the UK, there wasn't an awful lot of conversation about mental health at all. So it was quite a lonely time for her and for me, sort of trying to help her.
And you found yourself raising three children, and they're pretty close in age, Margot, aren't they? You must have had your hands full raising very young children pretty much by yourself. This is not an easy task.
It's not, and I think one of the great things about your mother not telling you that
right,
is that you do find yourself knee-deep in diapers and school runs and juggling, you know, the full catastrophe of work and kids and life and illness and all those things. And I think the richness of life is trying to cram it all in at once, but also forgiving yourself for not getting it all right all the time.
Right. How could you possibly do that? There weren't enough hours. You could have given up sleep, I guess, but that's not an easy thing to do.
No, it's not. It was a wonderful and crazy time in my life. But I think the fact that they are all quite close in age means that they're all still quite close together. You know, they remember these times, mm-hmm. when things were stressed and pressed, like, you know, many of us, just trying to keep it together and also to keep our sense of humor at the same time.
Yeah. And isn't it wonderful that they are going to be together, too? I think I have two stepsons and a son, and the middle boy got married this past weekend. And it was so wonderful, Margot, to see the boys together, you know, giving speeches to each other and to be this unit that will, I'm sure, exist in some form and in some deep form long after I'm gone. And that's really a good thing. I would imagine.
Sorry, I was going to say, I think that's sort of the reason I've got goosebumps on my arms hearing you say that. I think that is actually the reason to, one of many reasons to have children is to create a luminous and kind architecture of siblings after you have left, because that's how your spirit lives on.
Yes. You talk about these questions early in the book, and these are pretty large questions that you think that your children should ask again and again, and maybe we should all ask as we continue through our life journey. Who are you, to what are you committed, and how will you serve? How do you answer
that?
Who are you?
Well,
how do you answer that?
I don't think you ever fully answer it, but I think the point of it is to frame the question and to use that as a guide as you go through life. And I think it allows you to kind of step back and take a pause and say, I have been given this incredible opportunity to breathe and to be alive. What am I bringing to this conversation, to these people, to this world? So I don't think I have, you know, at 49 now, finished answering that question, but it helps me every day to remind me to be very intentional with every day.
Mm-hmm. To what are you committed? You've been committed to a lot of pretty important international kinds of issues. Alleviation of poverty is a large thing to be committed to.
It is indeed. It's the two most complicated words put together in the world in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
I've always wanted to devote my life to advancing the common good.
Mm-hmm.
And at the World Bank, it was specifically focused on alleviation of poverty, which is, you know, you can imagine an enormous basket. But more recently, I've been working on training women leaders. And for me, in particular, women's leadership is a critical component to sort of promoting, you know, peace, prosperity, and stability in the world. So I was lucky early on to find, I suppose, my calling. And I've always wanted my children, whatever they choose, to be committed to it, because they will be, I think, a lot better at it. And, you know, they've all taken somewhat different paths. I'm about to say goodbye to my son tomorrow, who's going to Morocco to work in the Atlas Mountains on a farm.
Oh, really?
So he's off age 20, and then, you know, Charlotte is, you know, she's a journalist, and she's committed to, you know, shaking things up and making waves and keeping people accountable. And the middle one is, you know, an engineer, so she's building things.
Mm.
So I think this notion of commitment, whether it's to yourself, to an idea, to your partner, to your school, your neighborhood, your community, it's asking something more of yourself to show up every day.
Right. Yeah, it's a good thing to have at the forefront of your mind every day is how can you serve. So Charlotte's a journalist. That's wonderful, because she was the book kid. Oh, my gosh, did she read?
She read all the time. Ever since she was tiny, she did nothing but
read
the book.
Yeah.
I had to take the books away from her. That was her sort of punishment, was, no, you can't read anymore. It's midnight. You have to actually go to sleep.
And she was getting some of your books from the basement, right, when she was an adolescent?
She was. She just, the world of words and ideas written on the page, that's what, you know, she's committed to. And then she's turned that into, you know, being a writer and a journalist.
That's wonderful. And you also, I think that's one of the pieces of advice that you give along the way, that it's important to be able to write.
Yes, I think being able to shape your ideas, you know, it can be spoken or written. You know, they can actually, you know, your ideas can be painted. But I think, you know, I'm a writer, so the notion of being able to, you know, translate what you're saying and to be clear is, you know, it's something that I have to work at every day, because I think writing is a craft; it's not an art. And, you know, I'm sort of a by-mistake writer. I just started writing this book in longhand at nighttime and on airplanes and in the supermarket and going for a walk. It was, you know, I'm just sort of, you know, I started writing by mistake almost.
Hmm. Was it easy, though, because those people you were writing about were pretty near and dear to you?
It was very easy in some ways, because it was such a private effort. You know, I've written a book to each child. Because you can't just give one child a book, can you?
No, right.
So it was a very personal endeavor to each of them. So I just kept them very much in mind as I wrote. And so that made it, you know, it was an audience of one perched on my shoulder. So there was an intimacy there. And of course, you know, deciding what to put in and what to keep out, of course, which is something that a lot of people ask me.
Mm-hmm. What are the things, you say there are certain things a mother should teach her children. They're all pretty much launched now. What are the things that you felt that you needed to teach them? Be it about safety or make sure you learn how to write or whatever. What did they have to know? Learn how to swim, whatever.
Well, I think the big message that I always wanted to convey to them was that they were enough. That they should not look outside themselves for confirmation, and that the way they would perhaps succeed in life was to tell them that they are never going to be less alone. And, you know, I wanted to get to kind of the existential heart of being alive, and that was the only way I could describe it. And so this notion that they were enough in themselves should allow them to kind of anchor themselves in a sense of, you know, I would hope, quiet confidence. And that has taken me a very, very long time to come to that conclusion. So part of the writing of this book that was, I think, more difficult than I anticipated was having to understand certain truths that I was coming to and then convey them to my children. And these truths I had only understood as an adult whilst writing.
Is it harder? Was it harder, do you think, in your generation, and I'm older than you, so I know it was harder in my generation, but I'm wondering if generationally it was easier for your daughters to be able to have that sense that they were enough than it was for you, and simultaneously, has it always been easier for your son because he's a male?
Gosh, that is such a complicated question. I don't really know the answer to that, and I'm going to have to think about it. And I'm one of these people who will say, I don't know.
That's fine.
I have to think about that. I might be able to come back to that at the end of the interview. I don't know, but I will ponder and respond.
Well, I love what you said, too, because I think that really is a very important thing to know in life, that you are enough. That's a very big thing to give to your children.
Yeah,
it's very important.
I thought that, you know, some of the mistakes and failures that I had made, particularly in relationships, and I wanted them to sort of understand that they can't seek to replace themselves with somebody else's, you know, attention or affection. So the notion that a lover or a partner or a friend or a child, they can't enhance the essence of you, and you don't need to look outward. And I think that that was probably one of the most profound understandings I took from this 10-year journey of sort of clinging and reaching outside myself and realizing, you know what, at the end of the day, I need to be enough for myself. And that kind of gave me, I think, an anchor to be a better mother for them.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it takes a long time to learn that. I know it did for me a long time. All right, let's go to some of the things in the book, and we'll go all over the place now. I love this one.
Okay, that's fine.
choose your boss wisely. You've had some wacky bosses, Margaret. You really have.
Yes, I have. I'm not sure if I attracted them or they attracted me. It's been quite an interesting journey over 25 years. I mean, I'm Generation X, so kind of going back to the generational thing, our generation bridges the 35-year career with one organization versus the millennials who apparently can have, you know, 9, 15, 22, you know, jobs in their life. And I think the real thing that I have discovered and told my girls who are now in the work world is, not only should you choose your boss wisely, but when you have chosen that boss, and I really do believe in interviewing your boss and really talking to other people who have worked sort of with and for them, but when you have that boss, remember that they're a human being. It's so easy to sort of to make judgments about those who employ you and to turn them into the other. And we spend so much time at work that I think sort of giving your boss the benefit of the doubt, but also really learning how to manage up to them is really, really important. So I get with my girls pretty practical about, you know, their bosses. And so the somewhat hysterical, quite amusing, somewhat crazy bosses I've had have taught me quite a few things about maintaining my sense of humor and knowing when to leave when it just has got to the point where this is actually becomes, I think, quite damaging to your soul and your psyche. But I had to, you know, teach myself to, you know, sometimes bite my tongue, sometimes just, you know, quietly, you know, sigh and get on with it, and sometimes say, actually, this is wrong, and we're going to have a chat. So I have, yes, been all around the world with different bosses, and, you know, people just bring everything from home to work, so you do have to... you can't always, you know quite what you're taking on until you actually get in there. But I have, you know, talked to my girls at length about how to manage some of the madness that occurs at work.
And sometimes you've had to make a decision that was really a risky thing for you to do because you didn't find something immediately thereafter. Maybe you left thinking that you would, but sometimes you had to struggle. And I know when you were married and your husband lost his job, you both had to struggle, use your savings and then some.
Yeah, no, we did. It was a time of, you know, really high anxiety. He had lost his job, and then I was eventually to lose my job. And we, you know, we did what every sort of, you know, young couple does. You kind of, you know, if you have some savings, we were lucky to have some savings. He eventually found his calling, which was to become a private tutor again. And I finally got a job, but there was a lot of belt tightening and worry and freelance work and sort of clinging on by our fingertips and, you know, praying mm-hmm. that something would come up. And, you know, eventually it did. But, you know, life throws up. Life is zigzag. And I don't think I realized that when I first started off how zig and zag this was going to be. But I also maintain that holding on to your sense of humor and knowing... having great faith that things would turn out helped me a lot. So that's how we got through.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and I know not everybody has had a chance to read your lovely book, but it's okay because what we're talking about is common to many of you, and you'll have a lot to say about things that you wish that your mother had told you or maybe things that you have told your children, navigating life. Things I Wish My Mother Had Told Me is Margot Bergen's book, and she is our guest this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls. Her children are now out in the world, and this book is to them to help them be able to bring themselves the real essence of who they are and their moral judgment and their caring and their service and their intelligence and their special talents to the world. And her series of advice, she's pretty open about parts of her life as well. And life isn't an easy thing to navigate sometimes, so I think it's important that children know what we've been through, and she lets them know. And they're doing okay, thank you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, so these are all ways for you to reach us. That's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phone calls, if you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-486-8655. We're interested in hearing your story about navigating your life and helping your children navigate their lives. Navigating Life, Things I Wish My Mother Had Told Me. Margot Bergen is our guest this hour and author of that book. And we start our calls with Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Well, good afternoon, Kathleen. In 1946, right after World War II, our family moved in an old farmhouse in southern Wisconsin. And my father was working for a construction company driving a gravel truck. When he got laid off that fall, he was drawing $27 a week unemployment. So my mother went to the country store down the road about 2 miles and asked the store owner if she could run a charge account. And he said, yes. She said, I will pay you back in the spring when my husband goes back to work. She proceeded to do that same scenario for 7 years. Mm-hmm. And then in the spring of 1954, we were moving. And we still didn't have a lot of money, moving here to Viola. And one of the things she said, and she did, she said, I have to go down to that country store and pay my bill before we move. And that's been 70 years. Mm-hmm. That has stuck with me.
Oh, it's quite a story. Margot.
I think your mother had incredible integrity, and the fact that 70 years later you remember this and honor it is just incredible. Thank you for sharing that story. It's just that's what we do for our children. We go back and we put things to right, or we remember our debts to people and we honour them, you know, without any fanfare. So thank you. It's just, that's an incredible story.
Yes, it is.
I will share that with my kids.
Yes, thank you. Thanks, Eugene, and thanks for saying it on the radio so you could share it with many. That's an important part of what you write about too, Margot. Cede your moral judgment to no one ever. Commit to what you know to be right, or what you want. You must know yourself. People will bring their own egos and experiences with them, their ideas and opinions, their prejudices and bigotries. Listen and filter. Enjoy, listen and filter, but be your own judge.
Yeah, I think it's also one of the hardest things in the world. That's where, in some ways, writing is so easy and living is so hard. I think this notion of integrity, of being whole and being true to yourself, and I think particularly when we're young, it's so easy to be sort of buffeted by the opinions of other people and, you know, wanting to please people by agreeing with them, or being overwhelmed by people whose voice is louder or people who speak more quickly. You know, we've all been there at one point where we felt sort of overwhelmed by other people's personalities. And I think just taking the time to be by yourself so that you can start to develop your own judgments is absolutely critical to this notion of integrity or being whole.
And so how would you do that? Did you sit around the dinner table or the breakfast table and talk and ask your children what their opinions and thoughts were on news of the day, on what happened at school, what happened in life? How do you instill that?
Well, the table, the kitchen table, was in a sense our church. It was our ritual, and they will laugh and tell you that I'm not the world's best cook, but I have learned how to cook. And every night at 7 o'clock for, I think, 10 years, we sat down as a family. It was you know, a bit loud and a bit messy, and it was mostly, you know, lasagna.
That's all right.
'Cause you can reheat that. And we always asked each other the same question: what did you learn today? And just that simple question, you can go off down any rabbit hole, but the four of us would sit and talk about the things that we learned. And out of that would naturally come conversations about particular challenges that Charlotte might have had, and then Brenda would learn about, or something about sharing or caring, or something would come out. So it was mostly allowing the conversation to flow in order to find out where they were every day. And then from that, you can put in some of the kind of learning stories. But I liked to kind of evoke from them this notion of, you know, where they had been in their head that day, or what they had done at school, or what they had heard about. We didn't have a TV, so we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, we live in Washington, so politics and news and life and
right.
big ideas, but also, you know, who's doing the laundry. So
exactly.
Everybody had chores in our household. But that was how it was the consistency of engagement and conversation, which for me was really the way to keep close to them and learn about what was happening and guide them.
Mm-hmm. I love this phrase that you include in the book as well, and I guess it guides what I do every day. Never underestimate the value of a good conversation. Ain't that the truth? It's so important, and it's so important with our children.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, sometimes we get used to our children being around and then we wake up and we find they're gone. And I think, you know, there's so many different types of conversations that you can have, you know, the fleeting ones, the domestic ones, the profound ones, the forgettable ones. But words matter and they do lodge in your soul. And I think now I'm even more mindful of having a conversation because two of my three children live in England. So conversations become more precious, and, you know, the exchange of ideas and the bringing ourselves close to our kids and actually hearing them, you know, really being present when they talk is just, I think, critical to continuing a relationship with them as they get older, because my feeling is that as they get into their 20s, the stakes are higher, and we spend less time with them, and I think it's almost more important in terms of the formation of their kind of soul and psyche is the 20s when they're going out into the world.
I guess it's not terribly unusual because you are from England, but how did your children wind up in England? That has to be hard, Margot.
Well, it was not entirely surprising because once Charlotte said, I'm going to do the exam to get into university, then her sister put her hand up and I thought, oh my goodness. So it's, you know, technology helps. helps a lot.
Right.
And but yeah, no, it's I do miss them. There is a real tug. Mm-hmm. Not sure where the sun is going to end up, but probably someplace over there as well.
Mm. Maybe you will as well sometime.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Going back, it's a big question.
Mm-hmm. Annie in Waterford is next. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Kathleen. Good afternoon. I just wanted to say I'm really enjoying the conversation. I have a daughter that's 30, and she's pregnant, so I'm expecting my first grandchild, which I'm really excited about.
Great.
But she sent me a text message one day when she was at work, and she said, "Do you think I'm selfish for not wanting to give up reading for pleasure and my artwork when I have the baby?" And just the first thing I said to her, I'm a musician and I've always performed. So I just messaged her back, "Did you think I was selfish?"
Hmm.
And her response, of course, was no. And I'm like, you have to give your children all of yourself. If you take part of yourself away, then basically you're lying to your children. So I encourage young women to be who they are, embrace all the parts of who they are. And I think I'm going to have to read this book so I can give some of this advice to my children. But I'm just really enjoying the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Annie. How much do you give? It's an interesting question, Margot.
It is absolutely fascinating. Where to start with this? I would say that you must set aside time for yourself, because I really agree with Annie. You can't give all parts of yourself away to your children. Otherwise, there's nothing left of you. And they are looking to you to give a degree of balance and stability. And I think that if you are a musician or a reader or a painter, you know, the definition of selfish is simply focus on oneself. And it's taken on a very negative connotation. But I, you know, write about the book that, you know, Charlotte looked after the younger ones for 90 minutes once a week so I could go for a walk or take a bath or read a book. And it was the thing that really saved my sanity. And mm-hmm. if it's the thing that replenishes you and allows you to flourish, then you must definitely hold on to that part of yourself. Otherwise, you know, you're not showing up as the true you. You're showing up as simply one identity, which is simply, I am now a mum. And I don't think that's enough, and I don't think that's very satisfactory to just be that one character.
Thank you so much, Annie, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, and Margot Bergen is our name. Navigating Life, Things I Wish My Mother Had Told Me. What about in the realm of school, in the realm of learning? You talk about how the only things that you really cared about in school that absorbed you was poetry and writing, and you had a lukewarm interest in everything else. Do you wish that your mom had told you, listen, you've got to really study some of these other subjects, or is it okay that those were the things that you loved and look what you're doing now? So you chose wisely. You chose what your talents are.
Well, I think I sort of, rather selfishly self-selected. I went to a very strict boarding school, and we didn't come home more than, I think, probably every 12 weeks. So she really had no idea what I was studying.
mm-hmm.
She did occasionally see my report card. And I think she was sort of involved with her own life, so I didn't do terribly badly at all the other subjects. But I think it would have been a more balanced thing had she kind of told me I had to take chemistry and physics. But I don't think either the chemistry or the physics teachers actually wanted me in their classroom. Because I always used to show up with a book of poetry, and they would roll their eyes and say, oh, my goodness, she is completely the wrong candidate. So, yes, of course there should be a balance in our learning, because I think we take from different strands, you know, from the arts and the sciences and the humanities, and it makes us more all-rounded. But to be honest, I just was not very interested in physics and chemistry.
Right.
But my children had to take them.
And did you notice in them, in all of your children, that they had certain kinds of talents that you noticed really early in life?
I think I was trying to talent spot, because I think my parents had not particularly done that. They were really sort of not involved at all in my education. And also my children did not go away to to boarding school, so they lived, you know, under my nose. So I was looking for things that I thought they might be good at, and then to encourage them at that, because I thought, you know, if I can sort of unleash their passions on the world early on, my second, who's an engineer, did nothing but put together Lego toys for her brother and her sister.
Isn't that something?
And, you know, she would take them away and say, you lot are just absolutely, you're not qualified to build anything in three dimensions. And, you know, when she told me she was going to go into civil engineering, it was just such a given. And my son is a brilliant debater, and it was clear from the moment that he just could speak that he would run circles around all of us. And Charlotte was a brilliant writer, and it all just kind of came out. You know, we don't have any scientists, and we don't have any doctors, and we don't have any lawyers. We have a very narrow gene pool. It seems to be writers, engineers, and talkers.
It's not bad. It's a pretty good gene pool.
It is.
When you say that you, one of the reasons for doing the book was you wanted your children also to know who you were, and you've exposed, you know, not everything in the book, but you've exposed a lot of yourself in this book as well. And it's always a tricky question for parents is how much to expose about their own lives, and actually how much your children want to hear about their parents' lives as well. Why did you expose as much as you did, and how did you decide what you were going to tell your children?
Well, I think what happened was there was a decade of writing the book. So the first sort of couple of years that I wrote this, it was easy enough. I was talking to her about learning and school and cooking and conversation. But as she grew older and as my writing became, I suppose, deeper, I realized, you know, that I was always going to have to do what I had set out to do, which is to tell her the truth about my family and my background and my struggles. And it was difficult, but I also think that, you know, how many people do we know have suffered from depression or addiction or suicidal thoughts or job loss? You know, all of these things have sat on the doorsteps of many people we know and love.
Yes.
So I thought, why not just tell her the truth?
Mm-hmm.
And there it is. And it turns out that having written the book, I've had so many people talk to me quietly about the things that have gone on in their lives. And I think actually one of the things about being a parent is it can be a very lonely exercise. You're surrounded by all the noise of your kids and you go to work. But there's actually not a huge, you know, it takes up a lot of your time. And there's not a huge amount of time for intimate friendships the way you perhaps had when you were younger, right, or going to, you know, high school or college. And, you know, I found in writing the book so many people have come up to me and said, gosh, you know, my mum was like that, or, you know, my father drank too much, or mm-hmm. there was addiction in my family and that kind of thing. And it just seemed to be the appropriate amount of truth to tell her. I mean, you know, it was the truth.
Right. And you went through very hard times with your father, didn't you?
Yes, he was a very complicated man, and you know, he became complicated with other people, and I think you know, alcoholism is a you know, it's a chronic disease that really affects behavior so profoundly, and that was something I particularly wanted to explain to my children, who were quite close to him in the early years, but as he sort of deteriorated, you know, less so. I wanted them to understand the story that happened to him.
Why?
Because there's no other explanation for the behavior and his ultimate downfall other than explaining the steps that occurred.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't satisfied with a sort of pat answer, well, you know, Grandpa kind of went mad. That's not sufficient. I don't want to talk in euphemisms. I want to explain about an illness, which is addiction, and I want to explain what happened to him. And so that they would perhaps have compassion in understanding,
right,
that somebody with such a bright beginning, mm-hmm, ended up where he did. And I did not want them to feel ashamed. And I had grown up with a huge amount of shame. I think children of addicts do have a lot of shame, and I certainly did. And I thought, let's just walk through the story to make it more understandable.
I think what happened to me, I've had some of that in my family as well. And what I did with it, I did too much of this, Margot, is I just wanted all of them to realize what could happen if you drink too much. You know, I must have given those lectures I don't know how many times.
Yes, I have been right there with you.
Have you?
Oh, my gosh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. And actually, you know, I haven't had a drink in 2 years, and it's been a really powerful thing for me just to sort of put that on the side and not to have to deal with it. And they've seen that. And it's been quite interesting having those conversations. You know, my father came from an honorable line of six generations of alcoholics, and this is right. Something that really is inherited.
Yes, yes. Yeah, well, I'm glad somebody else is with me. I'm not sure anybody heard me, but I certainly have given the talk many, many, many times. Deborah in Brown Deer, our next caller. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I wrote a little poem, and it's quick, so this is what it is, and I think it just tells my story. But people suffer every day. It could be me, I often say. But truth be told, my observations have not improved my situation. My perseverance is where hope lies, because I believe bad things are good things in disguise.
Thanks, Deborah, for your poem. You agree with that?
Beautiful. Perseverance is such a brilliant, brilliant word. Deborah, thank you so much. I think that summarizes. I was trying to write down that poem, but I realized that I didn't quite get it all down, but I can come back and listen to this. Yeah, perseverance. It should be everybody's middle name, I think. And the notion that bad things are good things in disguise really goes back to the genesis of writing the book, which is from a very dark space. You know, you can take, you know, negative energy and turn it into good energy. You can turn things around.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. And there's also this, I think that motherhood sometimes can do this, and certainly people, some have them, this just innately, it's just who they are. But this idea, because you can get worn down, right? I mean, life can really get you worn down to the point where there are days when you just want to, I'm sorry, I just don't want to get up today. I'm just going to just not do very much, and you can't do it. And when you have children, you have these lives that depend on you. It's such a huge responsibility, isn't it, Marco? And you had three of these children, these beings who, for a long time, you have to take care of them, really take care of them.
You do, and I think you know, the amount of energy that you need to bring to appear stable and normal and not so exhausted that you're kind of lying on the sofa, you know, knocking back a bottle of Chardonnay.
Right.
I mean, you can do that when they go to bed. Yeah, it requires everything of you, I think. And for me, for many years, it was just simply, you know, trying to get on through and just really trying to survive without going under. And there was a moment also, I think, in writing the book that I woke up probably 5 years into it and thinking, I don't want to just survive anymore. You know, I need to turn this around. I need to be more positive. And, you know, the children got a bit older. You know, I had three kids in 4 years, so they were quite a tribe for a while. But I think as they got older, this notion that they also could help, you know, they actually became a positive force. They became less needy physically. Mm-hmm. You know, they could start to do their own things, become more of their own people. You know, they've always been required to work around the house and do things, but it became less of a physical kind of, you know, marathon and more of a kind of a psychological weight. But you know, you dig deep and you have a few good friends and you just put your head down and you go for it and you hope you come out the other end mostly intact, with your sense of humor.
Mm-hmm. How hard was it? I ask this not to pry, but I know that so many people are living in families where moms and dads who initially started together are no longer together. There, we have all these different kinds of family configurations now. How hard was it on each of your three children to have their dad and you living apart, and how hard was it on you to have that happen?
I think he is a very good father and has been a great ex-husband. So in some ways, it was much easier to have burst the bubble and explain to them very clearly and deliberately, you know, why and how we were divorcing or separating than it was in the lead up to it. logistically, it was quite difficult. At the start, it was, you know, emotionally, I think, quite traumatic. I don't think you can sort of, you know, pretend that divorce does not have a huge cost on children. But I think clarity is one of the things that we both learned. You know, this is what is happening. You are safe. This is the schedule. This is when you see daddy. This is when you see mum. And we structured it, I think, as well as we possibly could. And I think they adapted quite quickly. I think children are incredibly adaptable. As long as they believe you, as long as you are truthful.
Right. Yeah, truth is a very good thing, isn't it? It's really good to be truthful.
It is, because people smell you when you're when there's a gap between your, you know, your words and your intention. You know, people know that. We're primitive beings. Words are very modern constructs. People can smell you when you're just, you know, bullshitting them, essentially.
Yeah.
Sorry, I swore on radio.
It's all right. I think you can say that without problem.
Okay. The FCC aren't going to turn us off.
You're okay.
I'll never be allowed to go to Wisconsin. So I think they, you know, they know, and we've had lots of talks since, and they understood. And in fact, I was laughing with my daughter, you know, a few weeks ago, and she said, "Mum, our biggest nightmare would be if you remarried Dad." And I said, "I got it."
Our guest this hour is Margot Bergen, and her book is Navigating Life: Things I Wish My Mother Had Told Me. It's life's lessons. It's more than that. It's how she's navigated her life and the difficult times in her life and what she thinks would be good for her children to know about carrying themselves off into the world. It started when their family was going through a very difficult time. Her daughter, she has three children. Her daughter Charlotte was 9 years old, and it was presented to her when Charlotte went off to college. So it was 10 years in thought and in living and in writing. And this is what we're talking about this hour. Welcoming phone calls. We have time for a few more phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email, you can talk to us that way as well, is talk@WPR.org. And Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go back to phone calls. Margot Bergen, Navigating Life, Things I Wish My Mother Had Told Me is what we're talking about. And we go to Carrie next in Spring Valley. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I just thought that I would share my story a little bit. About a year and a half ago, my own mother passed away. And a month later, I was looking for some photos, digital, because she was very artistic. And I found what she had written for me.
Oh.
Which was absolutely a little book of advice. And it was called Did I Tell You? And it happened to be that I found it Friday night before Mother's Day. And so I was able to share it with my sisters. And I would just encourage everybody who has children, you know, even if you're not a writer, write down little things about what you've learned in your life. And you never know how it's going to affect your children and in their later life. It's just, it was very powerful for my sisters and myself.
Hmm. And do you wish that she had given it to you when she was still alive, Carrie, or was it more special to find it after she passed?
I do. She, in her last years, had a Lewy body disease, which is a form of dementia. And so she wasn't able to. And I kind of felt like after she died, she pointed me to that disc,
right.
You know, like, hey, I meant to tell you this.
Oh.
And it was dated 1998, which is how many years ago?
Hmm.
And this was just a year and a half ago that we found it. But she got the words across eventually.
Hmm. Well, that's quite a find, isn't it, Margot?
Oh, that's absolutely beautiful. What a wonderful, wonderful gift she gave you.
Mm-hmm.
And Did I Tell You is just, it's beautiful. It's really amazing. And you know, perhaps it was supposed to be found after she passed away. You know, there's such a power in having that new voice of hers come to you. You know, also, you know, as comfort. Thank you so much for sharing that. It's lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for sharing yours.
Thanks, Carrie, so much for your call. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Hello. I'm trying to understand the children's education. And And that how were the kids educated in their early years? And when you said you went to boarding school, and how old were you when you went?
I went to boarding school from age 11 to 18 in England, but they went to local schools in Washington D.C. So they were educated in America.
Was it hard to go to boarding school? I've never really known anybody who went to boarding school. Did you miss being home?
No, not
you didn't
at all.
Really?
No, it was great fun, and all my friends went. So it was one of those things that, my group of friends all went to one particular school from age 3 to 11, and then it was a Catholic boarding school. So then we all basically, the gang of six of us, then went to this boarding school. It was about an hour and a half outside of London.
Mm-hmm.
And it was strangely fun being locked up with nuns and 200 girls.
Of course, it sounds like a really good time. Oh, that's funny. But you didn't want your children to do the same.
No. I thought that being a single mum and then sending them off was just, it was a bridge too far. I wanted them close to me, and I really wanted to see them every day. And it was a completely different way of experiencing being, being a parent with kids at home, as opposed to, packing them off and seeing them 3 months a year. In fact, when we were at boarding school, legally we were wards. We were under the protection of the nuns because we spent more time with them than with our parents.
Hmm. Let's go to Mark in Richland Center next. Hi, Mark.
Thanks for the program. We've been told by our parents and by just about everybody that you can't do anything unless you have the money to do it. And yet, that's absolutely not true. If you bring on Stephanie Rierich at the Dane County Time Bank in Madison, Wisconsin, she can show you all kinds of things that the community can get done without the use of dollars or euros or any other currency. And the question is, if the doing that has to get done by the people is limited first by the availability of this thing called money. Even Joseph Stamp, a former head of the Bank of England, said, look, banks rule the world. They own the world. And if banks are the place from which we get money, we actually believe that we can't do anything. Well, the doing that has to get done, we can do by abandoning the use of money and realizing that we can give and receive credit to and from each other, and we can get a heck of a lot more done.
All right, thanks, Mark. What did you tell your children about money? Money's a big thing in our lives.
Nobody is neutral about money.
No.
Don't ignore it, and don't pursue it for its own sake, but understand how to manage it, how it motivates you, what you do with it, and be very, very clear about it. I have seen so many of my... I've come across people for whom money has been a cross to bear, whether they've had too much or too little.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've always talked to my children about budgeting, which is really about behavior. Ultimately, it comes up as a series of numbers, but it's about behavior, and it's about linking your behavior with a particular outcome. And, of course, please put aside 25% if you can for your future self, because that person will show up. And if you don't have the money to look after him or her, that's not a good thing. So, we have very explicit conversations about money. I've always been very upfront with it, even, particularly when I've had none at all. And, we've talked about, these things aren't possible, or this is what we eat because the budget is very tight.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Margot, we're out of time. Thank you ever so much for being with us. It was delightful. Thanks for writing down all your thoughts.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the program, and I will come to Wisconsin one day.
Great. Yeah, you would like it here. It's good.
Yeah. Okay, thanks
all right,
a lot.
Thanks. Margot Bergen looks a little bit like England. Wisconsin does. Certainly looks like Ireland. Navigating Life, Things I Wish My Mother Had Told Me. And Margot has spent the last 20 years raising 3 children. She's worked all over the world at many kinds of institutions. She was at the World Bank, the Center for Interfaith Action and Global Poverty, United Way, and now at ORB Media. And her 3 children are now off in the world. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again on Monday. And Monday at 1 is All Things Political, which has been on the air for a long, long time. And Ruth Conniff will be our guest. She's editor of The Progressive, so that's coming up on Monday. On Tuesday, we'll all be watching the debate. Lots of people are going to watch that debate Monday night, and we'll be hearing different points of view on analysis of the debate on Tuesday at 1 o'clock. So that's the story. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks for all of your calls and to our guest. And we'll be with you again in a few days. Have a really good weekend. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.